I'm not a good speaker, you see. When I start to speak, I have a measly 4 or 5 lines of thought. Sort of roads, you know, trails going various ways. And I have to decide which trail I'm going to follow. And while I decide, this hawing and hemming begins, and it may be very upsetting because I hear it myself. I can never understand those limpid, fluid speakers, as my father was, who just deliver perfect phrases, beautifully built, with an aphorism here, you know, and a metaphor there. I can't do it. I have to think it out. I have to take a pencil. I have to write it down laboriously, have it before me, do things like that. It's probably psychological. I can imagine what old Freud would have said. Oh, my heart really detests this. My readers know by now.
Mr. Nabokov, would you tell us why it is you detest Dr. Freud?
Well, I think he's crude. I think he's medieval. And I don't want an elderly gentleman from Vienna with an umbrella inflicting his dreams upon me. I don't have the dreams that he discusses in his books. I don't see umbrellas in my dream or balloons. The first part of my life is marked by a rather pleasing chronological neatness. I spent my first 20 years in Russia.
He began life in St. Petersburg, eldest son of an aristocratic but liberal family. The author of Lolita, Pale Fire, The Gift, and Speak Memory learned English from his governess before he learned Russian. At 18, the October Revolution destroyed his world, including his fortune.
The next 20 in Western Europe.
A poet, a composer of chess problems, a deviser of crossword puzzles. After Cambridge University, he lived as an exile in Berlin and Paris with his wife of 40 years, Vera. Their son, Dmitry, is now an opera singer. Vladimir Nabokov eked out a living by tutoring, translating, coaching tennis, as well as by writing his 8 novels in Russian.
And the 20 years after that, from 1940 to 1960, in America.
Here he taught literature at Cornell, Harvard, Wellesley, and Stanford. Before emigrating, he had translated 2 of his novels from Russian into English and written the first of his 5 English novels. His complete switch from Russian to English prose was exceedingly painful, but his lifelong love affair with the English language continues.
I've been living in Europe again for 5 years now.
Currently in an elegant Swiss hotel overlooking Lake Geneva.
But I cannot promise to stay around another 15 so as to retain the rhythm. Nor can I predict what new books I may write.
But he soon told us of one of his many works in progress.
I'm in the process of translating Lolita into Russian, which is like completing the circle of my creative life, or rather starting a new spiral. Shall I read 3 lines of this Russian version? Of course, incredible as it may seem, perhaps not everybody remembers the way Lolita starts in English. So perhaps I should do the first lines in English. First, Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul, Lolita, the tip of the tongue taking a trip of 3 steps down the palate to tap at 3 on the teeth, Lolita. Now comes the rush.
Note, by the way, that the first syllable of her name sounds more like an R sound than the O sound. Lalita, свет моей жизни, огонь моих чресел, грех мой, душа моя, Лалита. Кончик языка совершает путь в три шажка вниз по небу, чтобы на третьем толкнуться в зубы. Лолита.
Quatre et un cinq. Voilà. Merci.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Bonjour, monsieur Nobotov. Comment allez-vous?
Je vais très bien. Est-ce qu'ils sont venus?
Oui, oui, c'est là. J'ai reçu ce matin les journaux d'hier. Oh. Alors, est-ce que je peux vous donner tous ou bien si vous désirez seulement une part?
Non, donnez-moi seulement le Times de jeudi.
Le Times de jeudi.
Et le Télégraphe.
Le Télégraphe et le Guardian.
Et le Guardian d'aujourd'hui, oui. C'est
alors, ça. Je vous remercie. Vous me les avez déjà payés hier.
Ah,
alors, comme
voilà,
ça, aujourd'hui, vous ne devez rien.
Bien, c'est bien. C'est beau aujourd'hui. C'est
magnifique.
Un peu chaud pour le curling.
Oui, on m'a fait le curling. Je vous dis, on ne peut pas toujours le faire maintenant.
Vous êtes toujours champion.
On le fait en hiver.
Vous êtes toujours champion.
Moi, non, maintenant plus, mais j'ai été 10 fois finaliste et une fois champion suisse.
Ça, c'est
ça suffit.
Ça, c'est bon. Alors, je ne vous paye rien.
Non, c'est
bon,
en ordre.
Merci beaucoup.
Au revoir, monsieur. Merci, ça va, comme ça, parce que ça ne parle pas les
lunettes. Mais si, il va bien écouter. Si.
Oui, mais on a un café pour
toi. I live in Montreux for certain family reasons. I have a sister in Geneva and a son not very far away in Milan. And also because I find the view so wonderfully soothing and exhilarating according to my mood and the mood of the lake. Ever since the days when such formidable mediocrities as Galsworthy, Dreiser, Tagore, Maxim Gorky, Romain Rolland, and Thomas Mann were being accepted as geniuses, I have been perplexed and amused by fabricated notions about so-called great books. That, for instance, Mann's asinine Death in Venice, or Pasternak's melodramatic, vilely written, Dr. Zhivago, or Faulkner's Corncobby Chronicles, can be considered masterpieces, or at least what journalists term great books, is to me the sort of absurd delusion as when a hypnotized person makes love to a chair. My greatest masterpieces of 20th century prose are, in this order, Joyce's Ulysses, Kafka's Transformation, Bailey's Petersburg, and the first half of Proust's Fairy Tale in Search of Lost Time.
I notice there are no American masterpieces on your list. What do you think of recent American writing? Who are the best of our writers since, say, 45?
Well, seldom more than two or three really first-rate writers exist simultaneously in a given generation. I think that Salinger and Updike are by far the finest artists in recent years. Lots of Russian writers have strolled here, Gogol brooding on his dead souls and killing lizards with his cane, and Tolstoy courting housemaids and meditating on social welfare and other exciting matters.
Mr. Nabokov and his wife spent each of their 20 summers in America touring the country, collecting butterflies.
It's really the summers that are connected in my mind. It's a kind of rainbow, and they were really quite, quite wonderful.
He came to know and love the United States and its minutest distinctions of style and landscape, and he talks of returning to America soon, for good. Since 1945, he's been a citizen.
After all, that's the country where I have been happier than anywhere else.
The American Museum of Natural History contains several butterflies first described by this lifelong lepidopterist. One is known as Nabokov's nymph, a unique specimen he named many years before giving our language the word nymphet.
Personally, I don't think in words. It's not a verbal process. It's just a sequence of, or a blending of images. It can be something quite brief, quite short, a juxtaposition of two things, a brief compositional pattern. Then after that, it will fall into words because I know that the words are there, that they are somewhere behind the scene, that they are waiting to come up, you see. And the only difficulty is to find them. So that for me, what is called inspiration is a matter of recognition. Well, these are index cards, which they call in France fish bristol. And I buy them at a shop here, 100, 200 every time. And then I use them not only to jot out notes and things which I want to remember, but actually to write my the novel or story I'm composing. And then I rearrange them in a given order, because it doesn't matter really where I start. The thing is more or less in my mind. I just have to fill in the gaps. That's a very convenient arrangement, which a fashion or method that I acquired rather gradually. In the old days in Europe, I remember writing in copybooks.
After you finish writing on the cards, do you type them out and...
Oh, I don't type. So when I finish with the cards, and that means writing in pencil, erasing the card, rewriting it once or twice, then copying it out on another card, or turning the card around and copying on the other side, and losing the card. See, I see a soldier, like, I just throw it away. I threw three cards away the other day, like that. Well, after that, my very kind and patient wife, she sits down at her typewriter, and I dictate the matter on the cards to her, making some changes, and very often discussing this or that. She might say, "Oh, you can't say that. Can't say that." I said, "Well, let's see, perhaps I can change it." I start in the morning at around 8, half past 8. And I start writing here, and correcting proofs. Well, today I've been correcting proofs because I got two sets at the same time. And it's rather, you know, like the riddle of the Sphinx, the ages of man. But here I sit in another order. Here I stand. Then after lunch, I generally sit down here, after having rearranged my desk a little. It's an awful disorder here. And after that, when I feel the heaviness of the evening weighing upon me, I go here on the bed. That's where I end up. But it's very funny that sometimes after dinner, I suddenly feel very, very fresh and full of inspiration, and I go back to my to this lecture, I say. Yes. And so it starts all over again, like in a kind of cosmic arrangement. My pencil. No pencils here. Do you mind if I go back for my pencil? Ah, there it is. I like to correct proofs with this Florentine pencil, which my sister gave me. I have here a little note. I say here in the introduction that Here we are. This book has less white Russian appeal than my other emigre novels. And there's an asterisk and a little note. This did not prevent a communist reviewer, Sartre, J.P. Sartre, who devoted in 1939 a remarkably silly article. Oh, that's a bad misprint. It is not remarkable silly. It is a remarkably silly. Correct this. To the French translation of Despair that was in 39. And he said, both the author and the main character are the victims of the war and the emigration. Sort of wonderful seeing the author and the protagonist on the same level.
I have here some, not all, some of the editions of Lolita. These are all the editions of Lolita. Some of them are very extraordinary. See, this is supposed to be, I don't know in what language it is. I think it's Turkish. That's a Turkish Lolita. Now, if you look at the man and the girl, I'm not sure who is older. Absolutely wonderful. Then there are some remarkably pretty editions here. One of my favorite ones is, where is it? That's a very pretty edition, I find. You have her here, you see. That's a French edition. And you have her here. Other side. Delightful French edition. The German edition, which is very pretty too. The very handsome Italian edition. This is beautiful, that's a Dutch edition. Isn't it nice? Beautifully done. From the point of view of an artistic version, I think it's absolutely charming, Dutch. No often miss on this table. I have notes here in this copybook about the things I detest. For instance, italicized passages in a novel which are meant to represent the protagonist's cloudbursts of thought. Background music, can music, piped-in music, portable music, next-room music, inflicted music, concise dictionaries, abridged manuals, journalistic clichés, the moment of truth, the moment of truth. Humility. That's a splendid word. That kind of thing. These are the index cards of a new novel of mine.
Have you given it a title?
Well, it's a kind of provisional title. It's called The Texture of Time. I'm not sure I'm going to use it. There's a book called The Nature of Time, which rather interferes with that title. But it's really about the texture of time, of the thing itself, you know. It's very, very difficult to write.
But I find the more I speak about it, the vaguer it gets. the difficulty about it is that I have to devise an essay, a scholarly-looking essay on time, and then gradually turn it into the story I have in mind. The metaphors start to live. The metaphors gradually turn into the story, because it's very difficult to speak about time without using similes or metaphors. And my purpose is to have those metaphors breed, to form a story of their own gradually, and then again to fall apart And it all ends in this rather dry, though serious and well-meant, essay on time. It proves so difficult, yes, that I really don't know what to do about it. I think that the creative artist is in exile in his study, in his bedroom, in the circle of his lamplight. He is quite alone there. He's the lone wolf. Because as soon as he is together with somebody else, he shares his secret, he shares his mystery, he shares his God with somebody else.
You mentioned your tennis. We'd like to shoot you playing.
No, it's out. First of all, I haven't played for 3 years, Three years ago, I could still play a good game, but I wouldn't like to begin all of a sudden on a cold autumn day. Anything might happen. It would make a beautiful picture. Death on the tennis court. But, I think, well, we've played football. That was bad enough.
You mentioned a third sport.
Chess is my third sport.
Your indoor sport.
Indoor, strictly indoor. Very much so, yes.
But we will be able to film you playing chess.
If you like. It's not a very active kind of film. It's a very quiet film. It is still, really.
Can we stop now? God,
that's your move. That's good. Are we getting somewhere?
Can I get up now?
No.
Because there's nothing more to do.
Yeah.
I can't play football.
You're in a wonderful position. Come on. It's one of those blitz games, lighting games. Come on, darling. Come on. I can make a mistake, too. I could take it. Well, that's the beauty of those blitz games. Here we are. Oh, that's terrible. Yeah. Okay.
Now
it's the end, I'm afraid. Well, thank you, darling. It was an absolutely wonderful game. It's one of those fantastic games which are annotated and appear as masterpieces in chess magazines for years to come. This is a masterpiece, another gem, as they say.
Do you see any connection between your composing chess problems and composing your novels?
Yes, I think it's much the same thing. You also have the variations, the variants among which you have to choose. You also make false moves. And moreover, you make what problem composers, chess problem composers, call illusionary moves. Deceitful moves. Sometimes a solution, a false solution, is planted into the problem to mislead the solver. And the whole pleasure sometimes is in finding two or three false solutions, going through them and coming at last, sometimes to a very simple, actual solution of the problem. I think this kind of thing happens, in my literary composition too. Sometimes, I don't actually plan them, but they are there, those illusions, those delusions, those little labyrinths which seem to be the right trail, the right path to my object,
that actually lead the good reader astray.
What's your greatest pleasure in writing?
There is the first satisfaction of arranging it on a bit of paper. After many, many false tries, false moves, finally you have the sentence that you recognize as the one you are looking for, the one you had lost somewhere, sometime. And it seems perfect to you. It doesn't mean that perhaps 5 years hence it won't look to you horrible. Shall I talk on, or is that?
Yes,
because it doesn't hamper me in any way. I was on the track of something that I wanted to see. I wanted to follow up, but I'm such a poor speaker, and not having my cards around me, I'm rather lost. Oh yes, you were asking me about the pleasures of writing. Well, the first pleasure, I say, is of seeing the thing on your card. Now, the next pleasure is of, in my case, is of reading it to your wife. She and I are my best audience. I should say my main audience. After that, when a thing is published, I do imagine a number of people whom I like, whom I admire, with whom I feel close kinship. It is nice to think that those people are reading that, perhaps at this very instant. But that's about all. I don't care about the general public. I'm sometimes very much touched by the fan letters I get, and especially by those that I get from remote parts of the States. From Kansas, from Texas, as a matter of fact, from South America, too. People are writing to me to see how much they enjoy the book and picking up, deliberately or not, little things which show me that they not only understood the book, but that they liked it from the same point of view as I liked it when I was composing it. I think that's a great joy. That's another kind of joy. That's much more human than this first thrill of diabolical pleasure that you have discovering that you have somehow cheated creation by creating something yourself. Takes care of your question.
Nabokov. 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 Vladimir Nabokov.